Well, good evening. Thanks for being here this evening. My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here for Faith Community Church. Just want to thank you for taking the time to invest it here this evening for this Faith Forum. This is our fifth Faith Forum at Faith Community. Started a few years ago where we had our first one on the gospel and same-sex attraction with Rosaria Butterfield, and then the gospel and racial reconciliation with Richard Brown. Last year in November, I think it was, toward the end of the year last year. It's Sunday night, so all my details are like Tim Prince's, if you know who he is. Sorry, brother, just threw you under the bus. You've only been here for 3 minutes, right? Last November, I believe we had Brian Gibson here to talk about the gospel and sanctity of life. Tonight, talking about the gospel and immigration. And then next month, mark your calendars right now and get out your mobile devices, if you would, please. And mark for April 22nd, we're going to be talking about the gospel and human trafficking. And so I am grateful, especially for this cycle of faith forms, because we're talking about the image of God, being made in the image of God, the sanctity of human life, and the obligation that we have to care for one another, serve one another. And, you know, these faith forms are places where we can come and we can talk about issues that are divisive in our culture. And hear about what does the gospel have to say about these things, because as Christians, confessionally, we believe that the scriptures are what guides us first and foremost, and so we need to know what is it that the gospel says about these things, and then how do we work them out. With all the faith forms that we've had, there are these interactions between gospel, church, state, federal government, and ethics and morality, all sort of mixed together. And so again, one of the reasons why we want to focus on the gospel and each topic is because as Christians, what we're called to do is to believe the gospel and to take the gospel into our hearts and work the gospel out into every area of our lives. And so I am grateful to have both Matt and Liz here tonight. A word about how faith forms work is we have, I will pray for us in just a moment, and then I'll invite Matt up, and Matt will present for a while, and then he'll invite Liz up, and she'll present for a while and tell a little bit about her story as well. And then after about an hour or so of presentation, I'll come up, and then we'll have a Q&A, and I'll moderate a Q&A. You can see we've got microphones up here on either side, and you can ask your questions. The reason we have microphones, I think, is for two reasons. One is we tend to think that our voices are heard by others, and our questions are heard by others when we say them just out loud, unmiked, and that rarely happens. The other reason is these are being recorded, right? This is being audio recorded, and so we want to make sure and have the volume, have your questions on the recording as well. There is nothing more frustrating to me in listening. I've listened to thousands of presentations and lectures over the years, and there's nothing more frustrating to me than hearing speakers answer questions that I can't hear what the question is because the question wasn't mic'd. And so I want to ask that if you do have a question, that you would come up to the mic and you would use the mic to ask your question, okay? The Q&A will go on. We have about anywhere between right around 50 minutes probably set aside for a Q&A. We don't have to use all that time. We might use that time. And then toward the end of that time, I will draw that time to a close. And then I'll invite Zach Zimon up to talk a little bit about his journey. He grew up here in Hudson and now is working with Arrive Ministries. And he will introduce some other ministries that we have out in the cafe area and in the front entry area as well, and tell a little bit about his story. And then we'll dismiss for the night. Okay? Straightforward? Everybody says, yeah, sure, great, cool. All right, thank you. Great. So let me start out by praying, and then Matt, you can come on up, all right? Father, thank you for your goodness and your grace and your mercy. Peter reminds us that we are sojourners. We belong to a country that isn't here yet, and we look forward to it. We thank you that one day that Jesus will return and he will make everything right. And God, I ask that until that day that you would help us to live faithfully to Jesus. I ask that you'd help us to think hard and well about the gospel and how we live it out. Thank you that the gospel is transcultural and that it can enter into any culture and transform people. And God, I ask that you would have your hand on our time tonight. I ask that where we have disagreements, we would disagree with charity and grace as we're called to do. I ask, God, that you would help us to think clearly and that you would help us to, as well, wrestle biblically with what the gospel calls us to and what you call us to be like. Thank you for Matt and for Liz and for their stories and for their work and that they're here to help educate us, help us to think these things through. God, I ask just personally from my own heart that I would be listening and listening well and learning. Thank you, God. In Jesus' name, amen. Come on up, Matt.
Thank you so much. Well, it is a pleasure to be with you all, and for me to be back home in Wisconsin. I grew up not here in Hudson, but out in the Fox Cities in the city of Neenah. So if you don't know where that is, look at a manhole cover at some point. It probably was made at the Neenah Foundry. But I always enjoy getting to come back to my home state. I now live outside of Chicago. But I wanted to introduce myself a little bit as we dive into what can be kind of a complex and difficult topic. And I really love the framing of this as the gospel and immigration. I think often, even as Christians, sometimes we think about immigration issue as a political issue, an economic issue, a cultural issue, a security issue, all those dynamics, and those are all fair perspectives, but maybe we don't think about it as a gospel issue or as a Christian issue. I know that was true for me for most of my life, where I grew up in Neenah. Frankly, there weren't a lot of immigrants around that community. In my elementary school class, I can't really recall anyone who looked particularly different than I did. And if I thought about immigration issues at all, it was what I heard on television or heard on the radio or what got forwarded to me in email as I got older. And I don't ever remember, though I grew up in a really wonderful Bible-believing church that I'm very, very grateful for, that, you know, along with my parents, introduced me to Jesus and taught me to respect and revere the scriptures. I don't remember ever hearing about immigration in the context of church. You know, it wasn't something there were sermons on or something we did in small group studies. Of all the Awana verses I memorized, I don't remember a lot of them being about immigrants. And I think that was true for me even as I went on into college. I went to a Christian college down in Illinois, Wheaton College, and it was there that I really started thinking about this issue. And actually, it wasn't there so much as a summer missions trip after my freshman year in college in San Jose, Costa Rica. And I would like to tell you that I had this deep sense of calling that God was sending me to Central America, but mostly I think I didn't want to get a summer job. But I ended up in Costa Rica for the summer with this Christian ministry, basically volunteering, playing soccer with kids, and helping lead Bible studies in broken Spanish. And most of the kids that I was interacting with were Nicaraguan immigrants to Costa Rica, or the children of Nicaraguan immigrants. And I learned pretty quickly, being there in Costa Rica, that a lot of Nicaraguans have gone south to Costa Rica, going back to the 80s because of war in Nicaragua, and then more recently for economic reasons. Nicaragua's still the poorest country in Latin America. Costa Rica's much better off economically. And so there's a lot of Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica, and they're not universally loved by every Costa Rican. In fact, I learned pretty quickly that a lot of Costa Ricans, certainly not all, but a lot of Costa Ricans had some strong opinion about Nicaraguan immigrants. Even my host family, who are a wonderful, amazing family who I love dearly, they're Costa Rican, part of a local church, but they would say things like, you know, all the crime committed in Costa Rica is by Nicaraguans, which seemed a little bit unlikely to me that all the crime was committed by Nicaraguan immigrants, but that was sort of the perspective. Or, you know, I heard some of them have diseases, or you'd hear things like, they're lazy, or they're taking our jobs, which I never knew quite how to put those two together. But that was the general sentiment around these Nicaraguan immigrants. Even on the public bus, you'd see really ugly graffiti. All the bad words I know in Spanish, I learned in the graffiti from the San Jose bus system. And often those words were next to the word Nica, a Nicaraguan person. But then I was ministering in this community and playing soccer with these kids and got to know some of their families, and they weren't perfect families, they weren't perfect people, but they were pretty normal people, living in some pretty tough conditions, working incredibly hard, much harder than I've probably ever worked in my life. And it started to bother me that they had such a bad rap. And that stuck with me when at one point I asked one of my Nicaraguan friends, you know, so why would you come here? Like, it seems like you come here, you work really hard, aren't particularly appreciated here. And one of them said to me, Mateo, here we've got food on our plates and work and a little bit of money to send back to our elderly parents back in Nicaragua, and that's all we could hope for. And that really stuck with me. coming back to the Chicago area, where there were actually a lot of immigrants in the Chicago suburbs where I was living, but I didn't know any of them. And so the other thing that really made me think about this on a personal level was a few years later, I was in a class at my college at Wheaton, and a classmate of mine made this announcement one day that she was volunteering with World Relief, where I now work. She was helping resettle this Rwandan refugee family who'd come as refugees from Rwanda. If you know anything about Rwanda, they had fled the war in 1994, the genocide, and they were now starting a new life in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, and they had four daughters and one son. And my friend Anna Ruth said, you know, I've really connected really well to this family. They've just become really dear friends. But I just feel like their son in particular, who was 12 at the time, would benefit from a male mentor. And I thought, you know, I have the reputation for behaving like a 12-year-old. I could be great at that. So I volunteered and started spending time with this family. And very quickly, they just became really good friends. Both Dennis, this 12-year-old boy, who's still my friend. I had lunch with him just a few months ago. And his family, his parents. And all of a sudden, I started to think about this idea of refugees as well. People who, the legal definition of a refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution because of their race, their religion, their political opinion, their national origin, their social group, and they've been forced to flee their country because of that persecution that they face. And a small percentage of those, somewhere between 0.1% and 0.5% in the last several years, are invited each year to come to the United States and begin a new life in the United States. And Dennis's family were among the lucky small percentage that were selected. And then after I graduated from college, I, like a lot of people graduating from college, I figured out I had to go live somewhere. So I actually moved into the neighborhood where Dennis and his family lived, an apartment complex in suburban Chicago with families from about 25 different countries of nationality. So I have families, neighbors from Burma and Iran and Somalia and Sudan, from Mexico, from China, from India, from Poland, various parts of the world. And many of them, probably most of them, were refugees who'd come in with legal status, were settled through World Relief. A few others were not refugees. They were other kinds of immigrants, some with legal status, some I eventually figured out not with legal status. They were here illegally. And that made me uncomfortable. I didn't quite know what to do with that dynamic because I'm called to love my neighbor, and these people are literally my neighbors. And I'm called to follow the law and respect the governing authorities. That's in the Bible, too. We'll talk about that. And I just was really conflicted in how do I respond to this issue as a follower of Jesus? What does that look like for me if I'm going to be faithful to following Jesus in this circumstance? Well, I also, about the same time, got a job with World Relief, which is the humanitarian arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. World Relief, our mission statement is to empower the local church to serve the most vulnerable. And we actually got our start right after what you might consider the last great refugee crisis the world has faced, after World War II, when an incredible number of people were displaced in Europe. And a church in Boston basically decided they were going to fast and pray in the season leading up to Easter and put some of the funds that they would have spent on meals towards reconstruction in Europe and towards helping those refugees in Europe. So that became, they pooled together some funds with some other churches. It was the War Relief Commission. And then a few years later, they converted that to be World Relief and said, you know, we could even go beyond Europe. We could go beyond this immediate disaster and look at issues of poverty and refugees, displaced people all over the world. So we've been doing that for a long time as an organization, always through local churches and in partnership with local churches. And then in the late 70s, we'd done that overseas. In the late 70s, there was a missionary couple who had spent most of their career in Vietnam, and they had come back to the United States after planting churches in Vietnam, and there was, as the Vietnam War began to escalate and Saigon fell, they started getting telephone calls and telegrams and letters from some of the people in the churches that they had helped to plant in Vietnam that basically said, is there anything you can do to help us? We've had to flee from our country. We're under threat. We're in danger. And this couple, Grady and Evelyn Mangum, and Evelyn is still alive. She's in her 90s, lives down in Orlando. I interviewed her a year or two ago, and if she was half as feisty in her 50s as she is in her 90s, I can imagine she is quite the force of nature. But she basically, they started calling every church that had ever supported them in their ministry in Vietnam and said, we've got a family coming. They worked with the U.S. State Department to figure out how to get some of these families here. And they would call churches and say, we need to meet them at the airport. We need you to help this family get on their feet. And many churches said yes. And when some churches, you know, were a little reserved, Evelyn told me there was one church that said, you know, we've got a new parking lot project we're really busy with. And she just said, well, these are people. So you'll be at the airport. And they were at the airport. And that was the origins of World Relief's Refugee Resettlement Program, which we've been doing since the late 1970s. Eventually, that couple ran out of churches within their own denomination and said, well, they came to the National Association of Evangelicals and said, can we work with all these other evangelical denominations because we need more churches. They ran out of their phone directory of calling up every church in their denomination. And so World Relief has done that since the 70s. And it's gotten a little more formalized since then. The State Department has a few more checks on things, certainly. But since then, we've resettled almost 300,000 refugees just through World Relief. We're one of about 9 agencies nationally that welcomes refugees into the United States, including most closely here in the Twin Cities through our affiliate Arrive Ministries, which I think we'll hear a little bit out towards the end of the evening. But I give you all that as sort of an introduction both to me and to the work that I do working with World Relief. But because our mission statement at World Relief isn't just to help refugees integrate into the community, though we want to do that, or help other immigrants integrate, fit in, though we want to do that, our mission statement is to empower the local church. So as you probably are aware, this issue of immigration, issue of refugees in particular in the last few years, is a little bit controversial. We didn't necessarily go looking for a controversial topic. We've been doing this for decades. But especially in the recent years, it's become a really heated political issue. I would probably prefer it wasn't a political issue, but it is. And so we began to wonder a couple years ago, how are Christians, especially evangelical Christians, which is kind of our background, how are they thinking about this topic of refugees, of immigration? So we actually commissioned a survey from a group called Lifeway Research. They're a Christian polling firm. And we wanted to get a sense of people who describe themselves as evangelical Christians in the U.S., what are their views on immigration, on refugees? So I'll share just a few of the findings. The first thing that we found was we basically asked, when you think about immigrants arriving in your community, what does that mean for you? And we gave them a bunch of different options. You could check more than one of those options. But what we saw was a trend was about 57% of evangelical Christians, about 69% of white evangelical Christians said that the arrival of immigrants presented some sort of a threat or a burden for them. What was more troubling to me was only 42% said that the arrival of immigrants to my community presents an opportunity to introduce people to Jesus. Now, if you're an evangelical Christian, regardless of what you think about the economics of immigration, maybe you think they're taking jobs or the security issues, they might be a safety threat, I would hope that we would all still say, but there is an opportunity here to introduce people to Jesus, because we want people to know about Jesus. But most people in most evangelical churches don't necessarily have that perspective. And I suspect that what might be at play there is it's hard for us to see an opportunity when we've fixated on what we've perceived to be as a threat. And we can talk about whether those perceptions are fair or not. But my challenge is, how do we see what God might be doing in the midst of immigration? You know, the government has an important role here, we can talk about that. But I think we sometimes only talk about the government's role, and we forget to talk about what's the role of the church. How do we respond as followers of Jesus to these realities? The other thing that we found in the survey, which also was a bit troubling to me, was that only 12% of evangelical Christians said that their views on immigration issue were primarily influenced by the Bible. In fact, the Bible, the local church, and the views of national Christian leaders combined were mentioned less often than the media. And this is self-reporting, right? I mean, if you work at all with research like this, you expect what's called the halo effect. The halo effect is basically people tend to give the right answer instead of maybe the honest answer. Well, if you're an evangelical Christian and the Bible was one of the choices, it almost doesn't matter what the question was. It's probably the right answer. But still, only 12% of people said, what's most informing my thinking on this is the Bible. And I actually could understand that because, again, I grew up in a context where I thought I knew the Bible quite well. I think I did know the Bible quite well. But if you would have asked me 12 or 15 years ago, before I had started into this work, what the Bible said on this topic, I think I would have struggled to come up with much of anything. Because it's not something we've necessarily focused on. That's why I want to spend actually really all of my time tonight, and we'll intersperse some facts and such as well, but I want to look at what does the Bible say that might inform how we think about this tough topic. We won't be addressing every area where the Bible might address this because there's too much. In fact, the Hebrew word for an immigrant, the idea of a resident alien, someone from one country going and residing in another, it's the Hebrew word ger. That's in the Old Testament 92 times. And that's just the Old Testament. So we're not going to go through every instance of that because we don't have quite enough time. But I want to just look at some of the general trends as we think about this topic. The first thing I think we should think about is the reality that many of the heroes of our Christian faith were immigrants at one point or another. Most famously, Jesus himself, who was a refugee. Again, a refugee is someone who is forced to flee persecution and go to another country. Well, if you think about Jesus' story, and we celebrate the Christmas story of his birth, my daughter Zipporah made a really, really, I think, smart observation. Last Christmas time, or maybe it was a year ago now, we got on our nativity set for Christmas. Probably many of you have a nativity set. It's like we have a nice little wooden nativity set we got as a wedding gift. And Zippy just likes to rehearse the whole Christmas story with that, like it's her favorite toy for the whole month of December. And she, you know, she's read the Jesus storybook Bible enough that she knows the story. The angel appears to Mary, and they have to go from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and there's a donkey, and then they get to this inn, and there's no place to stay, so they're in the stable, and there's some cute animals, and then there's some shepherds, and then there's some wise men. But then Zipporah made this really, really smart observation. She said, "Hey, Dad, our nativity set is missing a figurine. We don't have a mean king." I thought about that. Do any of you have a nativity set with a King Herod figurine? It's not really our favorite part of the story, right? I mean, most of us, if we have a Christmas pageant, it kind of ends with the wise men, the magi, bowing down before Jesus with the gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and then the curtain comes down and we all go home and have a nice Christmas dinner. But that's not where the Gospel of Matthew ends the story. In Matthew chapter 2, we read that as soon as the wise men and the magi were back on their way to their country, Joseph was warned in a dream that Herod, this paranoid, tyrannical Middle Eastern king, was coming to kill all the little baby boys in Bethlehem. And Joseph was told to get up in the middle of the night to take Mary and Jesus and escape to Egypt, where they would be safe. And we don't know a lot about the details of that trip from the text itself. We could guess that it would have taken a little while. This wasn't in an air-conditioned vehicle. It's probably a very difficult journey. We also don't know how Jesus and Mary and Joseph were treated when they got to Egypt. Very possible that some people welcomed them, had compassion on them. There likely would have been like a Jewish diaspora already living in Egypt who might have particularly, you know, had a commonality with them. It's also possible that there were some people who didn't want them there, who might have felt, you know, we don't know what kind of diseases this kid might have, or if they're a threat to us, or you know what, Joseph, we've got enough carpenters in this economy without you taking another job. That's just speculation. We don't know that from the text, but it is. One thing that is not speculation is that the roughly 22.5 million refugees in our world today have someone in Jesus who can very personally identify in his humanity with the experience that they've gone through, of being forced to leave everything behind, often getting up in the middle of the night because something dangerous is coming, and there's not time to make a plan, there's not time to figure out what you'd like to bring with you, but have had to be on the run. And Jesus himself, at a very small age, lived that experience. We could go through other characters in the scriptures who also were immigrants, whether that's Abraham, who was called by God on this promise to leave his country and establish himself in another country, or just a few chapters later, he's moving again, this time because of famine, economic hardship, or Joseph, someone whom today we would consider a victim of human trafficking, an involuntary migrant who was sold into slavery by his brothers and brought again to Egypt. Someone like Ruth, who today we would consider a family-based immigrant. She migrated into Israel to be with her mother-in-law. Although we don't have a mother-in-law visa in the United States, but I guess it worked back then. We could go through many of the heroes of our faith, and it's actually a pretty common theme that we may not think about. Another biblical theme as it relates to this topic of immigration, refugees, goes from the very beginning of the scripture. And that is that every single human being, not just refugees and immigrants, but including refugees and immigrants, is made in the image and likeness of God. And what that means is that every person, their life has value, has dignity, simply because they are a human person, regardless of any qualifier that you would put on that, regardless of where they're from or what language they speak or anything else that we could imagine that might modify their personhood. They are a person and their lives are valuable. Not only are their lives valuable, but they also, because they are made in the image of the Creator God, they have potential to contribute. And I think sometimes when we talk about refugee and immigration issues, we forget that potential that God has placed into each person. Not that he has exclusively done so into immigrants, but I think if you hear some of the language around immigrants, it's sometimes, well, these people are a burden. But I don't think that God sees any person whom he has made as a burden. It's a fair question to ask, well, how many jobs might these immigrants take or these refugees take? But if we're going to ask that question, it's also only fair that we ask the question, well, how many jobs might they create? Are any of you familiar with the name Sergey Brin? I see one hand there, maybe two. Not a common name, though, right? Not someone we hear a lot about. Sergey Brin came as a small child, as a refugee to the United States from the former Soviet Union, as a fleeing anti-Semitic persecution. He basically grew up here, went to school here, did quite well in school, started a small business, which actually a lot of immigrants do. Immigrants tend to have a very high rate of starting small businesses compared to native-born American citizens. Well, Sergey's small business went big. I almost guarantee you've heard of it. It's called Google. And I barely understand what it is, but it like lives in my pocket, and it told me how to get here today and has answers to every question I could have. And it employs tens of thousands of people. And that's not the only example. In fact, 40% of Fortune 500 companies were founded by an immigrant or their child. And I think that's worth noting because, yes, there are costs associated with immigration. It's appropriate to count those costs, but only if we're also going to count the contributions. Specifically looking at refugees who have come through the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, if you look at them 20 years after arrival, there's a really interesting study by some economists at Notre Dame last summer. 20 years after arrival, the average refugee has paid in $21,000 more in taxes than the combined costs of any assistance they received in the process of resettlement and any sort of public benefits that they were able to receive. Now, if you look at them 3 days after arrival, or even 1 year after arrival, it's a net cost. But if you look at them in the long term, it's somewhere around year 8 or 9 when they're actually paying in more than they're taking out. And that continues to grow throughout their lifetimes. And the net effect is, even if you're just looking at the economics, is positive. And you could do similar studies around other categories of immigrants. That's, I believe, because each of them is made in the image of God with that potential to contribute, because they're made in the image of the Creator. Another biblical theme, and I won't go through each of these passages because there's so many of them, but often in the Old Testament in particular, when you find that word for an immigrant, or the foreigner, the stranger, the sojourner, depending upon your translation of the Bible into English, it'll be right alongside the orphan and the widow. There was these three particular groups of people who are mentioned together all the time because they were uniquely vulnerable. And God makes very clear that he loves them, that he will provide for them, and he commands his people to provide for them as well, and to love them. Deuteronomy 10, very explicitly, God says that he loves those who are foreigners, therefore you must also love those who are foreigners. And I think it's worth noting that they were vulnerable, these three groups of people, at that time because this was an agrarian society and they didn't own land. So if you weren't inheriting land, you were starting behind everybody else. But God actually established in the books of the law systems to make sure that those needs could be provided for. So the Israelites were told they should go over their crops, their grapes, their olives, their wheat, one time, and leave what remains for the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow. So if you think about it, in the story of the book of Ruth, where if you've never read that story, you're reading it for the first time, it could seem a little bit weird. She decides to go glean in the fields, like go pick up what was left over, until you read the books of the law and realize, oh, that's what was available for the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, and she was at least two of those. Worth noting, I think there's a strong argument to be made that those three categories of people continue to be vulnerable in our world today. And actually, often they're interrelated. More than 70% of the refugees resettled to the United States are women or children, and a significant percentage of them are single moms, often who've lost their husband in a war or in a bombing or is part of the persecution that they've had to flee. They're also vulnerable sometimes even once they get here. If you look at victims of human trafficking in the United States and look at the prosecutions that the Department of Justice has done, 95% of victims of labor trafficking and 17% of victims of sex trafficking, which is are immigrants, foreign-born. In both cases, that's more than their share of the population overall, but especially among labor trafficking, it's obviously almost all labor trafficking victims are immigrants. And that's not incidental. Labor trafficking is when someone is made to work under force, fraud, or coercion. Basically, it's a modern-day version of slavery, where people may not be paid or are paid just a small wage, and then often they get into this cycle of debt where they're charged rent that's actually more than they're being paid for their week of work, and they never are able to leave their debt cycle. And we read about that sort of thing happening in other countries in the world, but it also happens in the United States. In fact, the Justice Department has estimated that as many as 17,500 foreign-born individuals are trafficked into the United States and made to work under trafficking situations each year. Another biblical theme is the command of God to the Israelites in particular to remember their own history as foreigners in the land of Egypt. We find that a few different times in the text, both in the book of Exodus as the Israelites are leaving Egypt, and then a generation later in the book of Deuteronomy as they're about to enter the promised land. And God basically says to them, look, you know what it was like to be foreigners and to be mistreated because you were foreigners. So when I establish you in this promised land, this land flowing with milk and honey, you need to remember that it was my grace that brought you from that place of desperation, that brought your ancestors from that place of desperation to where you are now. Because if you forget that, if you tell yourselves that this was all you, you pulled yourselves up by your bootstraps, then you'll forget my role, God says, in bringing you into this place. And you'll turn to the people who come after you, and you'll be just as terrible to them as Pharaoh was to you. And I think there's an application there for those of us who are Americans, which I presume is probably almost all of us, especially if you're not completely Native American, in which you might have a different story here. But most of us as Americans have an immigrant story of our own, whether that was on the Mayflower or into Ellis Island or on a slave ship in a form of forced migration, whether it was across the U.S.-Mexico border or into an airport. We could probably, if we had time, go around the room and talk about our own immigrant heritages. I'm Dutch. Almost entirely. Is anyone else here Dutch? A couple people? Did you grow up being told that if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much? You're all laughing, but it's kind of racist. My grandmother might believe it. But, I mean, I know that about my immigrant history. My ancestors came here in the 1850s. We've got like the little wooden shoes in my parents' basement and a little windmill out front of our house, and my dad says it's why we're stingy. It's just like part of being Dutch. I don't know if that's true or not. But that's about what I know about my immigrant heritage. And we tend, you know, whether you're Irish or Italian or British or French or whatever country your ancestors come from, I think it's fairly typical in the U.S. to remember some kind of cute cultural things, like, oh, we're Irish, so we have St. Patrick's Day, or we're German, so, you know, whatever. I didn't mean anything by that. But we often forget the hardships that our ancestors came through coming to this country. And there's been hardships alongside welcome basically throughout the history of this country. We have a very dualistic approach to immigration. In fact, you can look at Benjamin Franklin before this even was a country. He was in the British colony of Pennsylvania. And he said that these Germans who were arriving could no more acquire our language and customs than they could acquire our complexion. Which I think is funny, because I don't think I could go around the room and decide who was German and who was British based on their skin tone. But for Mr. Franklin, that was such a chasm, it was never going to be undone. And at the same time, you had George Washington saying, you know what, we've got a lot of space in this country. It is open to those of all religions and creeds who want to make their homes here, who merit that. So you've always had competing ideas, both politically and, frankly, you can look at the history of the church engaging this issue in the United States, and you see the same dichotomy. You have heroic examples of churches welcoming immigrants, sharing the gospel with them when they didn't come from Christian backgrounds, drawing people to Jesus and loving them very sacrificially. And you also, frankly, have moments in the U.S. history where particularly Protestant Christians were vehemently against immigration because the immigrants who were coming, for example, through Ellis Island, were largely Catholic and Jewish, not Protestant. And we didn't want these as immigrants from Ireland because they were Catholic, or from parts of Germany, or from later Italy, or Poland, or Russia. So we have a very mixed history. And I think the challenge of the biblical challenge here is to remember our history, to remember the hardships that our ancestors might have gone through, not so that we can be just as terrible to the next people as they were to us, but so that we can be better than that. And then there's this commandment to love our neighbors. And we find that actually in both the Old and the New Testament. First in Leviticus chapter 19. Is the first time that God tells the Israelites, you shall love your neighbors as yourselves. And then I think almost as if anticipating a question, which is, well, who is my neighbor? How do you define that? In verses 33 and 34, it says, when foreigners reside with you in your land, you shall not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you shall be to you as your native born. You shall love them as yourselves, for you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. So even if we just had the Old Testament to work with, we would know that that neighbor whom we're called to love is to be defined broadly. But then Jesus very much underscores that in the story that we think of as the Good Samaritan. In Luke chapter 10, a lawyer, a legal scholar, comes and says, So, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus says it's to love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And then it says in the text he wanted to justify himself, which is what lawyers do, right? So he has the follow-up question, well, who is my neighbor? And Jesus doesn't answer with like a precise legal definition. You get the sense this lawyer would like the response to be, well, your neighbor is someone three doors down on either side of the same race and religion and ethnicity as you, and you have to love those people. And I suppose if those were difficult people to love, you could move. But that's not what Jesus says. Jesus tells a story that we think of as the parable of the Good Samaritan. And it's probably worth noting, even before we go into that story, that a Good Samaritan was an oxymoron for most Jewish listeners. Samaritans were not good people. They were heretical foreigners. They believed the wrong things about God, and actually Jesus affirms that at one point. At one point, when some of Jesus' critics wanted to insult him, they said, isn't it true that you are demon-possessed and a Samaritan? Like, that was the best insult they could come up with. Or, you know, those are his critics. And two of Jesus' best disciples at one point were very eager to call down fire on a Samaritan village. And Jesus rebukes that attitude. In fact, Jesus' approach to Samaritans was very countercultural, consistently. It's a Samaritan who's the one out of 10 who, after being healed, comes back and says thank you. And Jesus lifts him up as a model of gratitude. It's a Samaritan woman, so she's got two strikes against her in this culture, who ends up becoming one of the first evangelists, sharing the good news of Jesus, that Jesus is the Messiah, with her whole village. And then in Luke 10, it's the Samaritan who is the hero of the story, the model of what it is to love your neighbor. And you all know that story. There's a guy beaten up on the side of the road to Jericho, and a priest and a Levite, the religious leaders of the time, come by on the other side, and they walk right on by. But a Samaritan comes, sees him in need, which means, first of all, that he had his eyes open, stops, has compassion on him, at his own expense, helps him meet his needs. And Jesus says, well, which one of these is a neighbor to the man who was in need? And of course, the answer is a Samaritan. And Jesus ends the story saying, go and do likewise. I think it's an obvious application for us that our neighbor is to be defined very broadly. It's not just someone of your same religion, not just someone of the same ethnicity. The Samaritan and the Jewish person beaten up on the side of the road, we're not the same. It's also worth noting that command to love your neighbor doesn't have a caveat. It doesn't say love your neighbor so long as it is completely safe. It's not love your neighbor so long as it is in your economic interest. Now, we can talk about the economics of immigration. I think it actually, broader picture, is in the interest of the United States overall. But we could discuss that. Even the security questions we hear a lot, especially around refugees right now. Well, how do we know those people aren't terrorists? The reality is the U.S. has a very thorough vetting process for the refugees who come into the United States. It's actually much more thorough than any other category of tourist or visitor who's coming into the United States. So it's just confusing to me, actually, that we had roughly 70 million tourists come into the United States last year, and so much of the concern has been around the roughly 50 to 70,000 refugees who've come in recent years, when they've already gone through a much more thorough process of vetting that usually takes somewhere between 18 months and 3 years to complete, involves in-person interviews with an officer of the Department of Homeland Security overseas, involves various background checks and biometric checks. And the best evidence to me that that system is working quite well, although I'm open to improvements, is that since the Refugee Act was passed into law in 1980, there's been 3 million refugees resettled into the United States, and a grand total of zero of them has taken an American life in a terrorist attack. Now, that doesn't mean they're all perfect angels. It doesn't mean that there's never been crime. It doesn't mean that nothing bad could ever happen. But it's actually a really remarkable record of safety in terms of the vetting that happens up front. But I think the point of the passage here is, even if that wasn't the case, and frankly, even for our brothers and sisters in Christ in other countries who are dealing with huge numbers of people fleeing persecution, showing up at their borders without the luxury of a 3-year vetting process. Our command is to love our neighbors as ourselves. Because it wasn't safe for the Samaritan to stop on the side of that road. It was a dangerous road. It's easy to criticize the priest and the Levite for walking by on the other side, but that's what I would probably do. Because I've been told not to stop and linger in dangerous places. I think that's how most of us think about these things. But the one who gets to be the hero of the story and the model of what it is to love our neighbors puts himself at some risk. Another biblical theme that I think comes up a lot when we talk about immigration issues is the command, and we see this in 1 Peter and particularly in Romans chapter 13, that relates to how as Christians we relate to the government. Romans 13, it tells us to be subject to the governing authorities. It says the authorities that exist have been established by God. It goes on to say they do not bear the sword without reason. Now that's not a passage about immigration per se, but where this becomes an issue is because for a lot of Americans, I think they hear the word immigrant and the first word that they associate with that is illegal. So it's worth noting before we talk about that reality that most immigrants in the United States do have legal status. About 70% of the immigrants in the country are here lawfully, whether as naturalized U.S. citizens or on a green card or a temporary but valid visa. Everyone who comes as a refugee to the United States is legally present from the moment that they arrive, and it's an indefinite status. So it's not necessarily a right association to think that all immigrants are here unlawfully. But there are roughly 11 million people by the best estimates of our government who are here unlawfully, meaning either that they overstayed a visa, that's about 40 to 50% of them, or they came unlawfully across the U.S.-Mexico border, or theoretically the U.S.-Canada border, although that's less common. So that's too big of a number for us to just sweep it under the rug and say, well, that doesn't matter. How do we think about that as Christians? And I think that's where this gets to be really sticky for a lot of us, because on the one hand, of course, we do want to love our neighbors. We also want to follow the law, and the Bible gives us good reason to follow the law. So how do we put those pieces together? One thing that I think is helpful if we're going to take seriously Romans 13 and this command to be subject to the governing authorities is to know what the governing authorities say. And the good news there is that if you are a U.S. citizen, it is actually fairly difficult for you to break U.S. immigration law. There is one very clear way you could do so, and that is by employing someone. If you employ someone who's not authorized to work, that is unlawful. But if you want to teach them English or invite them over for a meal or serve them communion on Sunday morning or run an English class or, I already said that one, or run a food pantry or any of the sort of ministries that a church would likely do, teach them Sunday school, even let them teach Sunday school so long as there's not compensation involved, none of those activities are unlawful in the state of Wisconsin or at the federal level. Now, this is an even tougher issue for those who are followers of Jesus and are here unlawfully. And that's actually a lot of people. There's a lot of people, whether they came as Christians or very often they didn't come as Christians and they met Christ here, and they are not present lawfully, whether because they overstay the visa or they entered the country unlawfully or for some extenuating circumstances. And this is an issue that I know a lot of them really struggle with. There's a guy in the neighborhood where I lived for many years. He's from Mexico. He's here illegally. Been here about 25, maybe 30 years at this point, so a long time. Came at a point of economic desperation with his wife and, at the time, 2 kids. Now he's got several more kids. He wasn't a Christian when he came to the United States, but after arriving here, he met someone who shared the gospel with him, and he became a Christian. He became a follower of Jesus. In fact, he ended up going to Bible school because he's a lay minister in his church. He's deeply committed to the authority of Scripture. And he's very familiar with Romans chapter 13. And he's desperate to get right with the law, to be subject to those governing authorities. And it's complicated, because his first step, of course, was to talk to immigration lawyers, to talk to our legal counselors at World Relief. And in his circumstance, he heard from everyone he went to, actually, there's no way for you to get legal. There's no way for you to fill out the right form or pay the right fee or have the right attorney. You can go back to Mexico, no problem. But no, there's no such thing in your case as going back to Mexico and coming back the legal way. There's no legal process for someone in his circumstance. Not in 1 year, not in 5 years, not in 10 years, no matter how much money he wants to pay. And I think it's important to know, in my background is in immigration law, I did not know this or probably believe this until I worked in immigration law. That's the typical situation. Most immigrants who are here unlawfully didn't qualify to come lawfully in the first place. Even if they would have waited a long time, even if they would have paid a fee, the way our visa system is structured, and this goes back to 1965, basically, with some modifications since, you either have to have a family sponsor, a close relative, not your cousin or your aunt or uncle or your grandparents, but a closer relative who's a U.S. citizen. And sometimes that's a fast process, but some of those visas are currently being processed from the mid-1990s, so it's a 20-plus year wait. Or you have an employer-sponsored, but all but 5,000 employer-sponsored immigrant visas per year are specifically designated for those who are highly skilled, so if you've got a master's degree or advanced level of education. If you're coming to do agricultural work, there's basically, you might qualify for a temporary visa, but the odds of getting a permanent immigrant visa are basically zero. Or the back of a restaurant, any sort of work that wouldn't be considered highly skilled. There's something called the Diversity Visa Lottery, which is a lottery online run by the State Department. The odds of winning that lottery last year were about 1 in 300. So better than one of those scratch-off games at the gas station, but not very good. And because it's designed to make the immigrants coming to the United States more diverse, you can't enter if you're from Mexico. Or India, China, South Korea, the Philippines, Canada, the United Kingdom, various other countries. And the last possibility is refugee status, meaning you meet that legal definition of having fled persecution because of your race, religion, political opinion, national origin, or social group. But again, this year, we anticipate there'll be about 22,000 refugees admitted to the United States in this fiscal year. That's less than 0.1% of the refugees in the world. So the fact that you are a refugee does not mean you get a golden ticket to come to the United States. If you're a refugee and you're amongst the most vulnerable cases that are selected through very stringent criteria. I just mention that because I think it's easy for us to say, well, they should just go come the legal way, and I think that should be the process. But we should know what we're telling people when we say that. For most people, there is no legal way. The trick is, if they manage to come here other than legally, they very often find a job very quickly and find employers willing to hire them. And in fact, find certain ways in which our government will accommodate that. You can file and pay your taxes if you were present unlawfully in the country with something called an individual taxpayer identification number. And most of my neighbors, I go to a Spanish-speaking church, do file and pay their taxes. It's one part of the federal government, the Internal Revenue Service, says you should file and pay your taxes, but another part of the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, which do not communicate, says, well, you shouldn't be here. And it speaks to the duplicity of our legal system. So my friend, who's, you know, he's part of this Baptist church, he's tried desperately to make things right, and he has considered then, well, then the only thing I can do is go back. He's considered that very seriously, but it's complicated there too. For one thing, he's married, and his wife doesn't feel the same level of conviction on this that he does, and he'd like to keep his marriage together. He's got kids who were born here, who are U.S. citizens, who are in high school at this point, and they, if he would choose to go back, frankly, they'd rather go live with their cousins or make it on their own in the United States, go to college in the only country they've ever, in the only language they've ever been educated. But he thinks it's his responsibility to be a father to his children. And then he would point me to a passage like 1 Timothy 5, where it says that if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And he doesn't know if he could provide for his family. In fact, even before he was a believer, that was the impetus that he felt this responsibility to provide for his family. Now, what's the right answer? What should he do? I'm not sure. But I do know that it's a little bit more complex than what part of illegal don't you understand. It's also what part of provide for your family don't you understand. And what I would personally love to be able to tell him is, here's the process you need to go through to make this right. Here's the fines you need to pay. Here's the hoops you need to jump through. But that process of reconciliation and restitution doesn't exist at the moment. Another biblical theme that I think is really important is the teaching in 1 Corinthians 13 and elsewhere that the church is one body and that every part of the body needs every other part. The hand can't say to the foot, I don't need you. The eye can't say to the mouth, I don't need you. And I think it's fair to extrapolate from that that the mostly white church that can't say to the mostly Latino church, I don't need you, and the mostly African-American church can't say to the Korean church, I don't need you, and vice versa. But I think sometimes in the United States, it's not that one part of the body would explicitly say to another part, we don't need you. Sometimes one part of the body doesn't know the other part exists. And that's especially true with immigrant congregations, which tend to rent somebody else's space on Sunday afternoons or have a kind of unmarked storefront without a very nice website. Sometimes they're hard to find. But the reality is the fastest growth in American evangelicalism today is happening in immigrant congregations. And if you talk to almost any evangelical denominational leader, they will tell you that's where their fastest growth is happening. In fact, the Pew Research Center in 2015 did this really fantastic, immense study of faith in the United States. And the headlines of that study were, Christianity in the U.S. is on the decline. Well, if you dive deeper into the data, actually, mainline Protestantism and Catholicism are seeing significant declines in adherence. Evangelicalism was roughly flatlined, and there was a lot of evangelical leaders who were really proud of that flatline. But if you dive deeper into the data, white evangelicalism, which is me, is on a decline similar to white mainline Protestantism or Catholicism. But you see this big uptick in non-white people, most of them immigrants of their children. In fact, the share of evangelical Christians in the United States who are not white went from 19% to 24% just in 5 years. That's a really fast growth rate. Now, I'm not celebrating that fewer white people are going to church. I think that's a problem that we need to be concerned about. But I am celebrating that more immigrants are coming to know Jesus and are coming to church. And frankly, they're revitalizing churches that need some revitalization in some cases. Tim Tennant, who's the president of Asbury Seminary down in Kentucky, says that from his research, 86% of immigrants either are Christians or become Christians in the United States, which is far above the national averages. He says this immigration issue might actually be the best hope for Christian renewal in North America. And I think with that celebrating of look at the number of people who are coming to Christ, who are joining the church, who are keeping us growing, we also have to live into the part of 1 Corinthians 13 that says when one part of the body, or 1 Corinthians 12, when one part of the body suffers, every part suffers with it. So the pain that is felt in immigrant communities needs to be something that we all share as brothers and sisters as well. And then, we already heard this alluded to briefly, but the reality is that immigration is actually one of the central metaphors for our Christian faith. And this doesn't necessarily tell us how to treat the immigrants who are here, but I think it's important to think through, especially there's this beautiful passage in Ephesians chapter 2, where it talks about how those of us who are Gentiles, which is probably most of us, were excluded from citizenship in Israel. By the nature of our birth, nothing we chose, we were outside of the promises of God. We were far from God, without hope in the world. And then through Jesus' death on the cross, which we'll remember this Friday, in a strange sense, that was naturalization day for us, because it was through Christ's death on the cross that reconciliation for those of us who are Gentiles to God became possible. But not only that, it made it possible the reconciliation across those ethnic lines as well. It says the dividing wall was torn in two between Jews and Gentiles, and I think it's fair to extrapolate between every ethnic group. Because of Christ's death on the cross, we can be reconciled one to another. And that needs to start with the church. Obviously, our society has issues as well, and you know, issues of race and ethnicity are not one-for-one issues of immigration, because certainly many people who are not white are not immigrants, and many people who are immigrants are Europeans of white, you know, skin tones, but these issues do come together sometimes. And the opportunities for racial reconciliation are, I think, really important. A couple more points, and I'm going to turn over to Liz, because she's more interesting than me. Especially as we think about refugees in particular, one really important biblical principle is that when we welcome those who are persecuted for their Christian faith, we actually have an opportunity to welcome Jesus himself. In Matthew 25, Jesus said, I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. And the disciples say, Lord, when did we see you hungry or sick or thirsty or sick or stranger in prison? And Jesus says, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did for me. I think one thing that's lost in the conversations about refugees right now is the reality that if you look over the last 10 years, at least among those refugees admitted to the United States, there's been more Christians than those of any other religious background. We tend to hear a lot of stories about Muslims, and there are Muslims coming as refugees, but nationally at least, the plurality are of a Christian faith background of one sort or another. And many of them are persecuted particularly because of their Christian faith. Does anyone want to take a guess at the number one country of origin for refugees to the United States in the last decade? Shout it out. China? No. Somalia? That would be probably the right answer. I'm sure it would be for the Twin Cities. But nationally, it's Burma, or also known as Myanmar. Somebody had it in the back, sorry. And what's interesting about the Burmese refugees is 70% of them are Christians. Not because 70% of Burmese people in Burma are Christians, they're less than 5% of the population, but they're uniquely persecuted, particularly a few different ethnic groups, the Karen, the Chin, the Kareni, who are largely Anglican or Baptist or Catholics. And it is because of their Christian faith that is a major factor in why they're persecuted by the Burmese government. In fact, the neighborhood where I lived, I had a lot of Karen Baptist neighbors. They like to celebrate Adoniram Judson Day every year, which is a name most of us have forgotten, but he was the Baptist missionary from America who brought the gospel to certain parts of Burma. In fact, at one point, one of my Burmese neighbors was at my door to make sure that I know who Jesus is. And frankly, I have some things to learn about following Jesus from her, because my Christian walk has been fairly comfortable. I have faced, at best, mild discrimination in my life, or awkwardness. We talk about persecution in the United States, like, you know, your Starbucks cup didn't say Merry Christmas, and we think we're being persecuted. That's not what I'm talking about. We have brothers and sisters who were forced out of their homes at point of a gun or of a knife, who lived for weeks at a time in a jungle, who ended up then living for years, or even in some cases decades, in a refugee camp, in desperate situations, because they insist on following Jesus. And I have a lot to learn about the gospel from someone with that experience. And again, when I welcome them, there's a sense in which I can be welcoming Jesus himself. And Matthew 25 goes on and says, the reverse is also true. When there's a stranger who is one of the least of these, our brothers and sisters, who we do not welcome, we are not welcoming Jesus. Of course, the flip side of that is that though the plurality of refugees coming to the United States are Christians, there's also a lot of people who are not Christians. And I think if we're very honest, that's where the refugee issue in particular gets controversial. If you look at immigrants overall, actually the vast majority are either Catholic or Protestant Christians. But among refugees, up to 40% some years have been Muslim. And that would be particularly true in the Twin Cities, which is, for whatever reason, a part of the country where a lot of Somali refugees, who are almost entirely Muslim, have gone. And for a lot of Americans and a lot of Christians, that's something that feels like a threat, that feels like a potential problem. But I actually believe it's a remarkable opportunity. I remember, you know, the church I grew up at, we had missions conferences where we would pray for the 1040 window. It's part of the world between certain lines of latitude where almost the entire region was unreached. There was almost no one who was a known follower of Jesus. And I think we should pray for that part of the world. We should do all we can to try to send people to that part of the world. But it's very difficult. It's hard to send missionaries to Somalia. Sometimes it happens, but it's extremely dangerous. And it's just, you know, there are parts of the world with very little religious freedom. But we have people from some of those parts of the world who land in the United States, where we are blessed with religious freedom, where we are free to share our faith, and people are free to receive it or to reject it. And I should be really clear, at World Relief, we don't do proselytism. We don't trick people into following Jesus. We don't serve them better if they're Christians. But we do believe in evangelism, rightly understood, which is being witnesses to who Jesus is. And frankly, very often that comes in response to questions. I find that most of our church-based volunteers are more uncomfortable talking about their faith than most Muslim refugees are. Because especially when it's a team from a local church that meets this family at the airport, that befriends them, that legitimately is loving them as their neighbors, who is walking with them through this adjustment to life in a new culture, it is rare that sooner or later they're not going to have the question of, wait, why were you there at the airport to welcome us? How much was your government paying you? Well, no, we were volunteers. We do this because we're Christians, we're followers of Jesus. And we love you because you're our new neighbors, and we're called to love our neighbors. And then there's all sorts of good spiritual discussions. And some of them are hard questions. Like, I've had, you know, Muslim neighbors ask me, so you guys believe in three gods? It's like, no, we believe in one God and three persons. That's a hard concept for most Christians to really articulate. It's particularly hard for people from a Muslim background who say there is one God every day of their lives. Or I've had people say, so you guys are Christians, you celebrate Christmas, what's the big deal with the big fat guy in the red suit? Well, that's not really a central part of our theology. That's kind of a cultural add-on. But that's the perception. And sometimes, frankly, the perception is, oh, you guys are Hollywood. That's what Christians are, right? Which is maybe not something we want to be associated with. I could pick of one particular neighbor of mine from Somalia who at one point came to my friend Josh, who was his English teacher through World Relief, and he said, hey, Josh, you know, I know you're a Christian. In my refugee camp in Ethiopia, I heard about this movie called The Jesus Film. Can you get me that in my language? It turns out we could get that for him in his language. You can get it in all sorts of languages. And Abdi was asking us those questions. And we have the opportunity, as 1 Peter 3 says, to be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks for the hope that is within us. And to do so with gentleness and respect. And that means, for us, we want to make sure people understand what our Muslim neighbors believe. That we are applying the golden rule by giving them the ability to tell us what they believe instead of reading about it on the internet. Because I don't like everything I read about evangelical Christians on the internet. and extending that same golden rule sort of idea of doing to others as we would have them do to us. And when we do so, we've seen many people make the choice, again, of their own free will, to begin following Jesus from parts of the world where they would be unlikely, frankly, to ever have had that opportunity or even heard that gospel message where they started from. I think one of the risks here is it's easy for Christians to presume, well, those people who aren't Christians, who are immigrants, are going to come here, and it's a mostly Christian country, sooner or later they're going to hear the gospel. And that's a bad assumption. The Center for the Study of Global Christianity at Gordon-Conwell Seminary finds that 60% of people of non-Christian religious traditions, so Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, 60% in North America say they do not personally know a Christian. Not that they've never been to church, they've never read the Bible, they don't know a Christian. And we might say, wow, there's a lot of Christians in Hudson, Wisconsin. Those people need to get out more. But maybe we need to turn the mirror on ourselves and say, how do we do a better job of getting to know those neighbors, of loving them as ourselves, the way we're commanded to do, frankly, whether they ever become Christians or not. And in the process, we might see many of them make the choice to follow Jesus. Because the flip statistic is that 35% of white evangelicals in the U.S., and I use that category just because it's what LifeWay Research, or Pew Research uses, 35% of white evangelicals in the U.S. say they personally know a Muslim, and an even fewer know a Buddhist or a Hindu. We hear a lot about people, but often we don't know them personally. And it's only in relationships that that sort of friendship that could lead people to the gospel can happen. J.D. Payne, who's a missiologist down in Alabama, says something is missionally malignant whenever we're willing to make great sacrifices to travel the world to reach a people group, but are not willing to walk across the street. One last biblical point and a story, and then I'll turn it over to Liz. And that's the biblical command to practice hospitality. I grew up thinking of hospitality as like having my friends over for lunch. Maybe like a really nice lunch, like something you find on Pinterest or something. But that's the way we use hospitality, that word in English, right? My wife and I had some friends over recently, and on their way out the door, they said, well, thank you so much for your hospitality. The problem with that is hospitality in the Greek of the New Testament is philoxenia. It is literally the love of strangers. So if you love your friends, that's great, but to paraphrase Jesus at one point in the Gospels, if you love your friends, big deal, everybody loves their friends. That's kind of the point of a friend. It's a good thing to do. Invite your friends over for dinner. I don't think we do enough of that in this country. But hospitality, what we're called to as Christians, is beyond that. It's to love those who are strangers to us, who are unknown to us. And that's countercultural. I grew up watching Saturday morning cartoons that were about stranger danger, right? Like, strangers are scary people. Strangers are a potential threat to you. That's the message we send our children. And I get why we send that message to kids. I have kids myself now. But I think sometimes even as adults, we carry that attitude with us. And sometimes maybe as a society, we're trained to see people who are different from us, who are new to us, as a potential threat. And we kind of avert our eyes and hunch up our shoulders. Now, I'm not going to tell you the Bible promises you that all strangers are safe. But I can tell you that the Bible commands us to love strangers. And literally in Romans 12, it's practice loving strangers. And when we do so, in Hebrews 13, it tells us that some people, by welcoming strangers, have entertained angels without realizing it. But 7 or 8 years ago now, there was a new family that moved into our apartment complex. A mom, 8 months pregnant, 3 kids from East Africa. And they didn't come as refugees. They came on temporary visas, and they were seeking asylum, which basically means they were fleeing persecution, but they weren't selected by the U.S. government abroad. They were going, you know, proactively to the U.S. government and making that claim that if I'm sent back, I have a well-founded fear of persecution. And what that means is World Relief didn't know they were coming. They just kind of showed up one day. And my wife, she speaks French, so that was like their fourth or fifth language. So she was able to communicate with them a little bit, and she basically, I think that we'd just gotten married, or maybe we weren't married yet, but I remember her coming over and telling me, this new family, like, they have nothing. Like, they're 4 people, soon to be 5, in a one-bedroom apartment with no furniture, just, like, bare apartment. They don't know their way around. They don't know where the hospital is, and this baby's coming soon. So we tried to practice hospitality. We tried to show love to them. We put up a message on Facebook and asked some people from our church, does anyone have some furniture, or even, like, an air mattress? And my wife was there at the hospital when that baby was born. And eventually their asylum claim was granted, which is a small miracle in itself, because those are not easy cases to win. And that meant the mom could get a job, and we helped her find a job. And in fact, even the older daughter, who was in high school, got a job. Their son was in a Bible study with me, and I got to see him baptized at our church. And over time, after a year or so, they actually were doing really well. They didn't need a lot of help anymore. They were just our friends. And that's actually our hope at World Relief as we help connect church-based teams to refugees is that, yeah, there's a lot of needs up front, but over time, it's just this mutually reciprocal friendship. And then after about 2 years, after they first arrived, their dad showed up, dad/husband. And it's a long story why he wasn't there in the first place. It goes back to the persecution that they were running away from. But I was there at O'Hare Airport in the baggage claim when he met his 2-year-old daughter for the first time. And I was just a weepy mess. I mean, they were all holding it together quite well, and I was embarrassing everyone off to the side, just like tears, you know, streaming down my face. Well, over time, he became a very dear friend as well. He and his wife became, in some ways, mentors to my wife Diana and me in marriage. And after a while, they were over at our house for dinner, and they asked a question, which, by the way, is not really culturally appropriate, but we'll forgive it because they're not from here. They said, "Hey, you guys have been married for a while now. When are you going to have kids?" And I remember Diane and I kind of looked at each other. How much do we want to talk about this? Because the reality is, this is probably about a year and a half, 2 years after we'd gotten married, and we'd been hoping and praying to have kids basically since we got married, and it hadn't happened. And we were starting to wonder if it wasn't going to happen. And so we kind of shared that. We said, "We'd appreciate your prayers." And my friend John Vieri, I remember he said, "I have the sense from the Lord that he's going to bless you with a child in the next year. I'm going to be praying for you." And we thanked him. But frankly, I didn't go start painting the nursery because it's not like I hadn't tried prayer. But it was only a few months later, we were over at their house for dinner this time, and we got to break the good news to them that Diana was pregnant. And I will never forget the moment when, you know, they speak, this is like their fourth language, so you see them processing our English into their minds, a little bit of a language gap, when they, in their eyes, you could see when they understood what we just told them. And they literally fell down on the ground, prostrate, laying down with all sorts of shouts of Jesus and Alleluias. It was like a Pentecostal church service in their kitchen. And they went on to tell us that they'd been getting up early every Thursday and fasting all day every Thursday and praying that God would bless us with a child. And that is somewhere. That is my daughter, Zipporah, with John Vieri and Marie. And she is, I have no doubt, the answer to their prayers. And to ours, but mostly to theirs, because I didn't fast and pray on Thursdays. So I'm going to turn it over to Liz, but close with that challenge. Practice hospitality. Practice loving strangers. Don't be surprised if a few of them turn out to be angels in disguise. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt. I've heard Matt share that story multiple times, and every time I get real emotional hearing it. But thank you. It's really great to be with you tonight. My name is Liz Dawn. I serve as the Midwest mobilizer for a coalition called the Evangelical Immigration Table, which is an alliance of several national Christian organizations that have come together to address immigration from a biblical perspective. So that includes the National Association of Evangelicals, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, World Vision, World Relief, and several others. And my story is that I would have never imagined myself doing this work if it weren't for God. So I'm going to share with you a little bit of my journey, kind of the path that God has led me on to bring me to where I am today. I was born in China, in the beautiful historic city of Nanjing, China, and my mom actually came to the U.S. first to do grad school. So she landed in Iowa, and she did 2 years or 3 years of intensive English study, didn't really know the language, and then went on to pursue her master's in business. And we come from a non-believing atheist family background in China. And by God's grace, he just brought Christians into her life in Iowa. One was her former school librarian, Cheryl, and the other was her former school teacher, Mary. And Cheryl Gibbs is actually cousin of Pastor Steve Holstein. And so Cheryl and Mary brought Mom into their respective families. And she would spend holidays with them, breaks, because it was too expensive for her to go home to China. And she didn't have any family or friends here in the United States. And they just loved on Mom and shared the gospel wherever, whenever they could. Now, my mom is very strong-willed, very stubborn, independent-minded, and she would just, you know, very hesitant, really reluctant about religion, about faith. But there was something about the way that they lived out their lives. Something about the authenticity of their faith put into practice in hospitality, showing love to strangers, that just it meant something really, really impacted her. But it would take her a while to finally become Christians. And of course, Cheryl's parents, Pastor Steve's uncle and aunt, Faith and Dale, adopt mom into their family as their Chinese granddaughter. So I became the Chinese great-granddaughter. And just treated mom and me after I came like family. In fact, after my mom graduated, finished her studies in Iowa and landed a job in Chicagoland, they made sure to connect her to their extended family members who were believers in the Chicago area, which later and then helped her plug into a local church. And it was one of them was the Hosting family in Chicago, Muriel and Daryl Hosting, and then also then their children. In fact, I was sharing with the Hosting family, I got a call from Muriel just right before our event to inviting us to Easter. We've spent just about every Easter major holiday, Mother's Day, with them and their families. And we spent just about every Thanksgiving with mom's former English teacher, Mary's family. And so after my mom landed a job in Chicago, that's when she switched from her student visa, which she had as a graduate student, to a work visa. And that's when she could financially sponsor to have me come, and when I was legally able to come and get a dependent visa. So I came to the U.S. at the age of 10. Didn't know any English, but what I often tell people, was really excited to come to America because it was a land of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, as I had known it, and I love Donald Duck. But it was challenging at first, just not knowing the language, and then living with mom, who I hadn't seen in 5 years. I stayed with my grandparents at the time, and just adjusting to the culture, the family setting changes. But mom, as I mentioned, was introduced to a local church, and she would go, mostly for social reasons at the beginning, but then I would tag along. And that's when I began to learn more and more about Jesus and God, and his love for me, and the work that Jesus Christ did on the cross to redeem all of creation, including me, unto his kingdom. And it was around the same time of me coming to know Christ that I came to find out some things that had happened with our immigration paperwork. So in 2001, my mom changed jobs. So work visas are employer-sponsored. And because mom now changed jobs, she had to get a new employer-sponsored work visa. And that was fine. Except in 2001, when that happened, our immigration attorney completely forgot to attach my paperwork as a dependent to hers. And then September 11th happened. What would have been enough time for my mom to move forward with her labor certificate application in process to eventually getting her green card, the government shut down processing paperwork, both applications and renewals, for a period of time. And my mom ended up missing an important deadline. So just like that, due to errors that were outside of our control, or errors by our immigration attorney, and then factors that were outside of our control, I lost my status as a 12-year-old. Even though we had done nothing to break U.S. immigration laws. And my mom tried to appeal her case to other attorneys, to our legislators. She went out to meet with, from Illinois, so with our senators, representatives, and the white consensus was there's no way for me to reinstate my status to fix our immigration issue. Short of self-deporting myself, incurring a 3- or 10-year ban or longer with no guarantee of reentry. And my mom, like I mentioned, stubborn. She was set on finding something, finding a solution, because we had done nothing to break U.S. immigration laws. But there was no fruit to that. So I came to learn about my status when I was closer to entering to high school. That's when I learned that without a valid Social Security, which I was not given, even though I came to the U.S. Legally, I could not drive, I could not work, and at the time I could not go to college, regardless of how I did in high school. And that discovery absolutely turned my world upside down. I questioned just my identity, my worth, my future, everything. And coming from a family and a cultural background that highly valued education, I didn't know what was going to become of my life. What was my life worth if I couldn't do all of these, you know, normal things that people did? And so high school years were very difficult, but it was really during this time that God showed his love of me through the local church, through his people. As mentioned, we started going to local Christian Mission Alliance Church and shared with a very small handful of people in my church because this was very sensitive personal information. And, you know, as a teenager, I just didn't really know how to share it. Didn't know how people would respond, how they would view me. They call me illegal, or they see me differently. And frankly, I just didn't really understand the legal fine prints to be able to explain it to people. Even me as an immigrant, I didn't understand the process. Would someone who's a citizen get it, empathize? So we shared with very few people, one of whom was my youth pastor. And Pastor Ben, upon learning about my immigration status, became actively involved in learning about this issue and advocating on my behalf, both within the church and also outside its four walls in the public sphere, meeting with our legislators, urging for a solution, a bipartisan solution that will allow people like me to earn our way to receiving our status, to be able to come out of the shadows and to lead productive lives. And my church family and our Christian family friends, the Hostings and others, prayed fervently with us and for us. I would get practical help in terms of getting rides because I couldn't drive, or other types of support. And as I look back, especially my high school years, just on top of wrestling with my identity as a growing adolescent and having to deal with my immigration status, and just having a really difficult time wrestling with my future, my identity, I never questioned the goodness of God. And I had people ask me, right, why did you hold on to your faith when you were put in a position that you didn't even do anything to cause? And I realized it was because it was God's love made tangible through his people. Because they affirmed my identity that was in Jesus Christ, regardless of my paperwork. And that my citizenship is in heaven. And my youth pastor could very well have said, ooh, that's a little messy area. Could have just patted me on the back and say, take care and be well. But he became actively involved in this area and loving me as a person, as a student, rather than seeing me based on my immigration status. So after high school, I enrolled in a local community college, which was indiscriminate against status. And I really believe this was an answer to the many prayers that were lifted for me and my mom. Still looking back, I don't know how this happened, but God opened a door for me to go to Northwestern University and on a scholarship. Because as an undocumented student, I couldn't qualify. Undocumented students do not qualify for any financial aid, even for me coming out of a single-parent household. In Northwestern, we became very plain and forthright in terms of where we are with our immigration status, and they opened the door. Even when at the time, some public institutions just outright rejected me and said, please don't come. And so I graduated college in 2011 with honors and still couldn't work because I didn't have status. And just, again, seeing my friends and my peers kind of go on to pursue great internships and jobs or grad school, and I couldn't do any of that. And I think God would use that time, again, to humble me. I volunteered, tutored, got really involved with the church, with the youth ministry, cleaned houses. And God would remind me that, my identity, right, my self-worth is not based on any diploma or job title. And I could not work legally until in 2012, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA in short, was implemented. DACA allowed individuals who came into the U.S. as children, so under the age 16, and are without legal documentation, to obtain a 2-year temporary work authorization and temporary protection from deportation. So deferred status from deportation. And thus far, approximately 800,000 individuals like me have applied for DACA. And while it's arguable the way in which it was implemented, But the effect of DACA is very clear, and I'm one blessed recipient of it. Because of it, I was able to come out of the shadow, supply the government with my information, and then be able to work. And I remember the day that I got my DACA permit in the mail. This is 12, 13 years after I found out about my status. And I became from legal to illegal in a moment's work. And I somehow became illegal to legal or documented in a moment's work. And I remember seeing that car in the mail, and my legs were shaking, and I couldn't even stand straight because I was just filled with emotion. And in my work now, I get the pleasure of working with other dreamers, as we're commonly known, individuals who were brought into the country as children. And we share very similar stories of being able to use DACA, deferred action, to be able to apply for jobs, to be able to pursue graduate school. I've had friends who were able finally to get married, purchase a home or a car, and be able to lead productive lives, which is all that we've wanted. Not a handout, but ways in which we can earn, in which we can reinstate and come out of the shadows. And so I started off in the private sector doing small business development for a stint. And when I moved in the community where Matt and his wife Diana lived to do ministry. And that's when I learned about the work of World Relief and the Evangelical Immigration Table. And Matt recruited me to do this work, which I just felt like I have absolutely no background in public policy. Have never taken a political science class in my life. Don't really enjoy politics. I'm not well suited for this position. But God, I just remember that God really convicted me and helped me understand that while I didn't have a voice, or when I was too afraid to speak up in high school wrestling with my status, there were people like Matt, there were people like my youth pastor, Pastor Ben, there were people like you sitting here learning about issues like this that were advocating on my behalf. And that meant the world to me, to have that. And now that I have temporary protection from deportation, that it's my turn to speak up, my turn to steward my story and my experiences. And so I joined World Relief close to 4 years ago, and have had just the wonderful privilege of working with churches and faith leaders on this issue, on immigration. Like Matt so eloquently covered, how to even just delve into scripture, which says so much about this issue of immigration. And for me, most personally, I consider myself a product of the church welcoming the stranger. And just to think that my mom, who was not a believer, who was actually quite anti-religion at the time, was welcomed into the church, into God's family, through Cheryl, through Mary. If it weren't for them, I don't know if we would be Christians today. And it literally took one or two individuals to practice biblical hospitality to change our lives for eternity. And I just think that the church has such an opportunity and such a responsibility to continue to welcome the stranger in Jesus' name. So that's a little bit about my story. And I think we'll transition next to a time of question and answer. So thank you for listening.
You guys want to take seats? Is that good? Yeah, okay, good. I was just reminded, or Deej, my wife, leaned over to me at one point in time. We were talking about Myanmar. I grew up in Rockford, Illinois, and my great-grandfather was one of the founders of the Swedish Baptist Church in Rockford, Illinois. And the Swedish Baptist Church eventually became Temple Baptist Church, and it's still there in Rockford, Illinois, and it's experiencing a great deal of decline. While immigrants, refugees from Myanmar are starting to be housed in the church and their worship services, and there's this great intermingling. And one of my dad's better friends now was at one point in time persecuted and now growing and pastoring a church. And it'll be interesting to see if Temple Baptist stays Temple Baptist Church. So it's just one of those types of things like, oh, wow, God is doing some amazing things.